Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on critical condition when we come back. Well, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school, and this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, citation, or complaint. And rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of the legal cases that you get involved in. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And your government is fully capable of making their own case against you without any help from you whatsoever. Now listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation and indeed, in many cases, police intimidation. The first case. Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? That comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. The second case, it says you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment in Belknap versus United States. And the third case, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent as well as the innocent and the farsighted, so says Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book called Critical Condition, new book just published in, let's see, it's November of 2004, about 6-7 months old. Critical Condition, written by Donald Bartlett, B-A-R-L-E-T-T, and James Steele, dynamite book on what's going on in the medical health field. So we talked a little here about these clerks at the HMOs that are paid to keep from answering your questions and how your calls for emergency services or doctor's appointments are screened out by non-medical people. These are not medical professionals. These are just clerks. Don't have any medical training at all. And they screen all medical calls. Your doctor doesn't get to hear from you until it goes through one of these insurance clerks first. Thought you'd be real happy to know that. But in addition to that, Madison Avenue comes into play. Madison Avenue Medicine. It's chapter 6. Chapter 5. Called Madison Avenue Medicine. And that's why these two authors called this Critical Condition. The healthcare system in the United States is in meltdown mode. So if you're wondering why healthcare in the United States is deteriorating, it's because it is becoming socialized. Not nationally socialized, the way we see socialized medicine in Canada or socialized medicine in England, but privately socialized by the insurance industry. So in this country, we're a little bit different than the rest of you communists and socialists around the world. We have, since Americans are opposed to government socialization of medicine have opted for private socialization of medicine through insurance. Isn't that just special? Well, every year, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services conducts a nationwide survey on the medical well-being of the American people. The 2003 study, like the ones before it, showed that most of us think that we're in good health. In fact, 35% of those questioned assess their health as excellent, and another 32% labeled their health as very good. Similar findings a year earlier buttressed the underlying health statistics that prompted Surgeon General David Satcher to sound a positive note. It said, in many ways, Satcher said, Americans of all ages and in every racial and ethnic group have better health today. I'm going to pause right there. And I want to tell you a little something about the health of America. In 1918, it was discovered that when young men were going into the army, you know, they give them a physical, and they found out that 60% of them were healthy, 40% had symptoms. Now, it was a great scandal in 1918. They said, oh my God, 40% of the young men of America, 40% are sick. They've got symptoms. They got to have glasses, hearing aids, they have allergies, and their eyes water, and a whole host and plethora of other things. They're diabetic or whatever. Today, in 2005, it's only 1% that are healthy. 99% have some kind of a symptom. But two-thirds of the people of America, if you ask them, how do you feel? God, I feel great. My health is excellent. Of course, the guy weighs 362 pounds, but he feels good. Now, but if two-thirds of the population rates their health as excellent or very good, how is it that so many of us are sick? In fact, by some accounts, we may be the sickest people on the face of the planet. At least that's what we're being told by television and radio reports and commercials. Newspaper and magazine articles and advertisements, medical foundations, universities, and the healthcare community itself. The numbers are breathtaking. Listen to this. Approximately 100 million Americans have excessive levels of total cholesterol. 100 million of us. Now remember, there's about 300 million in the country, or a little less, so a third of us have excessive cholesterol. The American Heart Association warns that more than 60 million American adults experience GERD, that's gastroesophageal reflux disease, according to FDA Consumer. 10 million individuals are estimated to already have osteoporosis, and almost 34 million more are estimated to have low bone mass. The National Osteoporosis Foundation claims that 3.8 million American children have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that's called ADHD. The American Academy of Pediatrics reports that more than 19 million Americans suffer from some kind of anxiety disorder. The Anxiety Disorders Association of America contends somewhere between 45 million and 60 million Americans now have the genital form of herpes, maintains Drug Topics, and an estimated 25 million adults have incontinence, significant enough to make it difficult for them to maintain good hygiene and carry on ordinary social and work lives, so says the Harvard Medical School. There's more. The Johns Hopkins Medical Institution say that 35 million people have irritable bowel syndrome. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists says 13 million Americans have thyroid disease. Medical Devices and Surgical Technology Week says 9 million men suffer from benign prostatic hyperplasia, called BPH, a non-cancerous enlargement of the prostate gland. The CDC says nearly 70 million adults suffer from chronic joint pain. Biotech Business Week says more than 2 million Americans have atrial fibrillation, a common arrhythmia that can result in an abnormally fast heart rate. The American Liver Foundation says 25 million people have a liver disease. NBC's Today Show says 2 million people have hyperhidrosis. It's a genetic problem that causes abnormal sweating. The National Institutes of Health says 12 million people have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and 24 million have impaired lung function. Then there's latent tuberculosis infection, 10 to 15 million people, male impotence, 30 million men, rosacea, 14 million people, eating disorders, 11 million, fibromyalgia, chronic pain in the muscles and tissues around joints, 6 million, obesity, 60 million, Alzheimer's, 4 million, chronic headaches, 45 million, psoriasis, 7 million, peripheral arterial disease, 34 million, hypertension, 50 million, clinical depression, 18 million, peptic ulcers, 25 million, chronic kidney disease, 20 million, allergies, 40 million, sleep disorders, 70 million, restless leg syndrome, 12 million, and excessive menstrual bleeding, 10 million women. Want to hear some more? Want me to go on? And 67% of us say that we're either in excellent health or we're in good health. I mean, come on, guys. Either the one-third that are complaining about something have all of these diseases and 67% of us don't have anything, or else the people that are saying, gee, my health is excellent, or my health is good, don't know what's wrong with them. You know, you may feel good. You know, I imagine people with diabetes probably feel good. Notice we didn't hit diabetes, multiple sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. I mean, there's 437 symptoms in the books. I mean, if we got in here and we hit you with all 437 symptoms, I mean, there wouldn't be anybody left in America that wasn't diseased. And then, hell, it's been going on since 1918. 40% of us were sick in 1918. 99% of us are sick today. Now, there's actually some good news here. 1% of us. How many people is that? You got 300 million people, 1%. 3 million people in this country are disease-free. Round numbers. About 3 million people in the United States of America don't have any disease. Now, of course, God promised you that you wouldn't have any disease at all. You'd have 70 years of life by contract, 25,550 days, no sickness and no disease if you'd practice these 18 health laws. I would submit to you that Americans don't practice all 18 of those health laws. Now, to be sure, this litany overlaps in certain areas. Some of the 58 million with high blood pressure most likely are among the 60 million with cardiovascular disease. And on the other hand, this list is far from complete, omitting scores of diseases, disorders, and conditions from cancer to chronic fatigue syndrome. If all those said to be suffering from some ailment are taken into account, it's estimated that there are more than 1.5 billion sick people in the United States, or five times the population. Assuming that one-third are in the excellent health that they claim, then two out of every three people you pass on the street are walking around with at least eight different diseases, eight different maladies. Now, are Americans really that sick? Well, of course not. So what's going on here? Well, simply put, it's in the best interest of a market-driven medical system to make you think that you're sick, or soon will be, or to get you to worry over the possibility. The grossly exaggerated numbers are in the best interest of everyone. Well, of course, everyone except the public that's paying for all of this medical treatment. For drug companies that offer multiple pills for every affliction, real or imagined, they mean billions of dollars for the bottom line, which helps explain why they are the country's most profitable businesses year in and year out. For doctors and hospitals, those inflated numbers mean more billions in revenue. For Madison Avenue, newspapers, magazines, television, and radio, they mean billions in advertising revenue and commissions, as well as increased ratings and sales. For testing laboratories and manufacturers of of expensive diagnostic equipment such as MRI machines. They mean more billions in revenue. For special interest groups, they mean billions in permanent funding for a bloated healthcare bureaucracy. For members of Congress, they mean campaign contributions and positive headlines as lawmakers wage a perpetual crusade on behalf of the sick. For celebrities raising funds for their favorite disease, they mean endless publicity and generous fees. Now, you know, as more individuals are encouraged to ask their doctors to examine them for conditions they don't have and treat them for non-specific ailments, they become an ever-growing drain on public and private funds. Now, the United States already wastes tens of billions of dollars on needless visits to doctors' offices, unnecessary or excessive medical tests, over-diagnosis, over-treatment, needless surgical procedures, and the unwarranted dispensing of prescription drugs on a titanic scale, thereby turning the country into the world's pill capital. Let me pause here for a moment, make a little mark here. Got to tell a story. Got a hillbilly lady, lives over here on Poverty Ridge. She had a brother. This lady is probably 50 years old. And she had a brother. He died here about 4 or 5 years ago. And I asked her, I delivered some milk over there, and they weren't home. And so when I came back to pick up the buckets, and I said, well, I missed you last Tuesday. And she says, oh, had to go down to Flippin' to my brother's funeral. And I said, your brother's funeral? I said, well, I'm terribly sorry to hear that your brother died. She said, well, you know, we all knew it was a-coming. And I said, well, you knew it was a-coming. What did he die of? And he said, oh, they just doctored him to death. Just doctored him to death. Well, I was kind of interested in, well, what did they do? Well, you know, he had this, I forgot what it was. He had some kind of a symptom, and he went to the doctor, and then they operated on his back, and then they operated some more, and then they just kept working on him until one day he finally expired. I guess he had insurance. We find here in the United States, if you don't have health insurance, you're diagnosed with cancer, the average lifespan of an uninsured cancer patient is 5 years. If you have insurance, the average lifespan of a cancer patient is 18 months. Yeah, I'm just giving you the numbers. I don't make these numbers. They come right out of the CDC and Department of Health, you know, in Washington, D.C. My wife had cancer back in 1978, and she didn't have any health insurance. And the doctor said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you on chemotherapy, and we're going to operate, and we're going to give you radiation treatments, and we're just going to do everything we can for you. And she said, well, wait a minute. Do I have terminal cancer? Yes, ma'am, you have terminal cancer. And she said, how much is this going to cost? And he said, well, about $100,000. This is $1978. That'd be twice that much today. $100,000. Well, how long do you think I'm going to live with all of this treatment? And they said, well, we can probably, you can probably expect about 18 more months of life. And if I don't go through this, well, you're going to be dead in the next 3 to 6 months. So let's see. I've got cancer, and I'm going to die in the next 3 to 6 months without treatment, but with treatment, I can live 18 months for $100,000. Yeah? Yeah. So you're going to extend my life for approximately 12 months. So you take $100,000 divided by 12 months, that's about $8,300 a month. So for $8,300 a month, I can live in pain and agony, and my hair can fall out. And it'll help you pay your boat payments and your house payments. But it's going to impoverish my family. So she left, and she said, no, I think I'll just go ahead and go home and die there. Well, she went home, got thinking about it a little bit, and she said, well, gee, the medical profession tells me they don't know what causes cancer and don't know how to cure it, but for $100,000, they'll treat me till I run out of money. Or until I die, whichever comes first, of course. So she got on to alternative cancer therapy, and the first thing she discovered was the Zion International Clinic up in Zion, Illinois. I went up there, and was a bunch of Advents up there, and they got her off of meat, pork, fat, blood, and unclean meat. And then she did the Ann Wigmore wheatgrass. That's what I'm looking at right here out of my studio office is into the greenhouse, which was built specifically for Jackie's Ann Wigmore wheatgrass therapy. And then she got off on another therapy or two, and here she is today. She's about 60 years old, and she's cancer-free, and that was 28 years ago. And she still does the therapy, and of course we still don't eat unclean meat. Now here's the moral to the story. There's a cure to cancer. In fact, there's 9 cures to cancer, been around for a long time. Cancer is one of the easier diseases to cure. There's some other tougher ones over here that you really gotta worry about, like Lou Gehrig's disease and a couple like that. But here's the story. Remember what this guy says in this chapter? He says, when we started the chapter off, he said, well, 35% of people say they're in excellent health, and another 30% plus say that they're in good health. And then I read to you all the statistics that come out of all of these major institutions that tell us how sick we are. Now, what's the real answer here? Well, we're still functioning and we're still walking around, but you know, we're taking all these pills. You know, today people who have diabetes call themselves, they say, well, I'm in good health. Well, sure, you know, they take their insulin, they're treating their insulin, their diabetes with insulin, and they feel real good. Or they've got allergies or whatever, and so they take Dristan, or they take some antihistamine or something like that, or maybe they have, a lot of people have asthma, and they run around with their asthma pills, and they got their inhalers and one thing and another. And if you said, well, how's your health, buddy? Oh, God, I feel good. I'm in excellent health. Excellent health. With asthma and an inhaler. Yeah, we can treat people, and we make a lot of money. You know, health is big business. $1.7 trillion a year. That's $17,000 billion a year. It's the biggest business in America. The biggest business in America is healthcare. Now, that's where we're at. Tuck it away in your heart. Now, the personal price tag for all of this is staggering. The paychecks of workers continue to shrink as they are compelled to pick up a larger share of health insurance premiums and copays. People with serious diseases are priced out of the insurance market. Companies tired of relentless health care cost increases are scaling back or canceling coverage for their employees and retirees. Saddest of all, the truly sick, the aged, the infirm, the families dealing with catastrophic illnesses are forced into poverty and bankruptcy. And a lot of money is being made by striking fear in the hearts of Americans that they will die prematurely unless they rush out and buy the latest medication. Few are profiting more from this tactic than the pharmaceutical companies, which hold the patent on profitability. New York-based Pfizer Incorporated, the world's largest pharmaceutical company, posted a 28% return on revenue in 2002. That was some 4 times better than Exxon Mobil Corporation, nearly 9 times better than Walmart stores, and more than 31 times better than General Motors Corporation. On a scale no one could have foreseen, the drug companies have enlisted the expertise of Madison Avenue to sell you their wares. Using techniques advertising has perfected over decades to entice consumers to buy soap, cereal, beer, perfume, and dog food, the drug companies are transforming the way we look at medicines and fattening their own profits in the process. From 1994 to 2000, spending for consumer drug advertising rocketed from $266 million to $2.5 billion. That's a whopping 840% increase. Sales of prescription drugs shot up from $79 billion in 1997 to $164 billion in 2002. At the present pace, sales will reach $250 billion by 2007. As a result of this runaway spending, overpriced prescription drugs are driving up healthcare costs for everyone. While drugs account for just 10%, 6% of the nation's total health care bill, they're the fastest growing component. Between 1993 and 2002, spending for hospital care went up 52% and outlays for physician services increased 69%. But prescription drug spending climbed 3 to 4 times faster, spiraling to 217%. This trend is likely to accelerate as the Medicare drug benefit takes effect fully in 2006, and Congress refuses to abandon a legislative policy that makes American consumers pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. I haven't bought a prescription drug. Let me think back now. The last time I bought a prescription drug, I don't know, I can't remember. I probably had one. I remember when I was about 18 years old, I had pneumonia and I had penicillin. I guess that's a prescription drug. Old Doc Olson in Fortuna, California, he was giving me a shot every Wednesday. I was coming in every Wednesday for a shot for about 6 weeks, $5 a shot. I remember that. I don't think I've had any from that day forward, and I don't have any health insurance, and I'm not sick, and so I don't know if I'm one of those symptom-free guys, you know, that doesn't have any ailments. I'm 66, and I feel pretty good. I guess I can say, hey, I'm in excellent health. Well, I'm not spending my money on health insurance. That saves me $10,000 a year, and I'm not buying any of these prescription drugs. In fact, I'll just bet you that this doctoring people to death, you know, 130,000 iatrogenic diseases a year, you know, all of these ADHD, Ritalin drugs you're feeding your kids, turning them into drug addicts, do you really think that that's wise? You ever ask yourself, Jesus, if my kid's got this ADHD, what caused that? Because, you know, I'm an old man, and I never heard of a kid having ADHD when I went to school. So that would tell me that this ADHD, whatever causes it, whatever it is, came about sometime after 1950. Came about in the last 50 years. You think maybe it could be called sugar disease. Did anybody ever think about taking those ADHD kids off sugar? Because every case that I've heard of where some kid had ADHD and the parents, you know, really wanted to cure the kid, you know, Ritalin treats the symptoms, calms them right down. That Ritalin will just drug them out, and boy, they'll just calm them right down. But to get rid of the ADHD permanently so you don't have to give this kid Ritalin to calm him down, so that he just acts natural without drugs, take him off sugar. Take him off sugar. In 2 weeks, you won't need any Ritalin. Wild new concept. Now, let's blame it on bad breath. Today's prescription drug ads on television owe their origins to a revolutionary change on Madison Avenue that occurred nearly a century ago. You see, the slick commercials with the appealing personal stories that play on everyone's fantasies and fears and urge all to buy the latest and most expensive drug on the market, well, that originated back in the 1920s when the stakes were considerably lower. It all began with the marketing campaign for a product peddled as a cure for bad breath. Here's what it is. In 1879, Dr. Joseph J. Lawrence, he was a St. Louis doctor, hit upon an idea for an antiseptic solution. 2 years later, he sold the formula to Jordan Wheat Lambert, also of St. Louis, who established the Lambert Pharmaceutical Company. That's the Lambert in what would become Warner Lambert, the giant pharmaceutical company today, to sell the new product as a multi-purpose antiseptic. And they named it Listerine. Listerine. In honor of Sir Joseph Lister, the Glasgow and London surgeon who in 1865 had first demonstrated the use of a disinfectant called carbolic acid during surgery. That simple innovation eventually reduced surgical deaths from more than 50% to just 3%. Well, that was a big step in the right direction. Half the surgical patients are dying, and they start using an antiseptic to kill the bacteria, and it drops to 3%. Within a decade, Lambert's company was selling Listerine to dentists as an oral antiseptic. Soon, it was used for everything from filling the cavity during ovary autonomy, an incision into or removal of the ovaries, to a cure for gonorrhea. The latter should not be surprising, since Listerine also is touted today in internet chat rooms as a way to avoid sexually transmitted diseases during oral sex. Prostitutes are urged to carry Listerine and rinse out after each client. Listerine sales were lackluster until the early 1920s, when Lambert Pharmaceutical Company mounted an advertising campaign that would transform it into a mass-market consumer item. The breakthrough concept would eventually have wide-ranging ramifications in her own time in the marketing of prescription drugs. In Listerine's time, the economic retrenchment of the war years gave way to the roaring 20s and sweeping changes in lifestyle and work. Well, it rolled across the country, and the explosive growth of modern appliances like electric refrigerators and gas stoves, along with the introduction of the automobile and new forms of entertainment, radio and motion pictures, transformed daily life. It was the dawn of the culture of consumerism. Listerine. Today you're buying all of these drugs because they pioneered it with Listerine. Well, hang on, we got to take a break here at the halfway point, and let me give you a couple of reminders, and we'll be back to talk a little more about Critical Condition, the review of the book Critical Condition by Donald Bartlett and James Steele, published by Doubleday, New York. New book on the market, tells you what and how the medical establishment is screwing you, blueing you, and tattooing you when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the U.S. and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the law school, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Remember to order yours. Just call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. That's again area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by us here at the Law Hour or necessarily endorsed by them of the Law Hour. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of the network or local radio stations. For more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to the website georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the book Critical Condition. Now, remember last night I pointed out to you that when you call in, you know, to one of these HMOs, the clerk that's going to field your call has a mission. He gets paid a bonus if he can handle your call in less than 3 minutes and 45 seconds. And if he can schedule or request appointments for patients in no more than 15 to 35% of cases, and if he can transfer fewer than 50 calls, 50% of those calls to nurses for additional help, he gets a 10% bonus. So if you have called one of these call centers, if you've wanted information, if you're a doctor and you wanted to get a bill, get paid for doing something, and they put you on hold or you get called, you know, you get moved back and forth to this or that computer, it's done on purpose. We're here to frustrate you. We're here to make sure that you don't get a solution to your problem. If it's at all possible, we're going to keep you away from any professional medical help. And I'm a clerk. I don't have any medical training. I don't have any medical expertise. And you've got a medical problem, and I'm going to diagnose that medical problem long distance over the telephone. And if it's at all possible, I'm going to keep you to hell away from the hospital, the doctor, or a nurse. And that's the policy. That's the way the game is played. That's the way it works. And you wouldn't have known that except you read it from Critical Condition. Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Dynamite book. I don't know the price of it. I didn't check before I came on the air. I'm guessing 25, 30 bucks. Worth every dime. A dynamite book. And then when you buy your insurance and if you're a complainer, you don't want to read this book. Because, you see, if you're a complainer and you read this book, you'll become the proximate cause of your own injury. I'm not a complainer, so I'm not really complaining. I don't pay. I don't buy health insurance, and so I'm not concerned. I don't have an HMO. I have a doctor. When I call my doctor and I want to get in, I can call my doctor today. This is Sunday, as I'm talking to you right now. I could call my doctor today. I'd have to call him at home. And, of course, I'd have to pay him for his services over here, but I'll bet you I could get him to see me today, Sunday. I pay in gold. And if I couldn't see him today, I'll guarantee I could see him tomorrow. And so could you. You know, you need to make a deal with your doctor, and he'll treat you with a discount if you'll pay him. Doctors are just concerned about getting paid, and they're not getting paid. In this book, Critical Condition, we'll show you doctors over here why you're not getting paid, why you're getting screwed, blued, and tattooed. And then you call the law school and come to my business class, and they'll show you how to solve that problem. Stick it to the insurance companies and pocket the difference. I've got many doctors that have learned how to do just that. Now, installment credit was introduced to fuel buying power. Buying power. It was encouraged by advertising that portrayed debt as a virtue instead of the biblical vice that it had been since the country's founding. New industries with their mass-produced products led to a glut of consumer goods. This, in turn, led to a new mission for the advertising industry. Make people buy more goods. The American citizen's first importance to his country is no longer that of a citizen, editorialized Middletown's favorite paper, but that of a consumer. Consumption is a new necessity. To pull it off required an original advertising philosophy, one that keyed ads to emotions. As one ad man put it, it may be necessary to fool people for their own good. Doctors and even preachers know, they know how to use and to practice that very technique. It's emotions. Now, the average intelligence is surprisingly low. It is so much more effectively guided by its subconscious impulses and instincts than it is by reason. Now, with that in mind, advertising people began to sell neither soap nor perfume. They began to sell youth, beauty, sex, and romance. They're not trying to sell you automobiles, but manly dominance and social prestige. And fear that if people did not buy Listerine, women would never find a husband. Men would forever live alone. Workers would never advance in their jobs, and everyone would be terminally ill. Everyone would have bad breath. Now, unhappy with sales of its 3-decade-old mouthwash, the president of the St. Louis-based Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, Gerald B. Lambert, the son of the founder, invited a pair of advertising copywriters, Milton Feasley and Gordon Seagrove, to come up with a new campaign. Now, to help with the project, Lambert asked the company's chief chemist to provide Feasley and Seagrove with background on Listerine. At one point in his conversation, the chemist dropped the word halitosis. Halitosis, it's an old medical term derived from a combination of Latin halitus for breath and Greek osis for condition. Breath condition. Halitosis. That was all the imaginative admin needed, with a single word, one that had a scientific ring to it. They launched a campaign that frightened the entire North American continent. Not because bad breath was a fatal malady, but because it was a social disaster. So in the campaign, they devised one advertisement featured the face of a man portrayed as a kindly doctor over a headline. "What I know about nice women," it began. "Listen to a doctor whose practice includes hundreds of the better class. It is simply unbelievable," he says, "how many women, supposedly nice, fastidious women, are suffering from halitosis and utterly ignorant of that fact. No wonder their husbands no longer kiss them, or that women friends avoid them. The ad promised that women would keep themselves, or could keep themselves, on the popular side by gargling with full-strength Listerine morning and night and before meeting others. What's more, Listerine was so powerful that it kills even Staphylococcus aureus, that's called pus, and Bacillus typhosus, typhoid germs, in 15 seconds. In large type across the bottom, the ad pronounced, "Halitosis is a daily threat. End it with the safe antiseptic, Listerine." Now, perhaps the most popular ad in the series played to women's fear of failing to find a husband. One version depicted a bride at the top of a spiral staircase, throwing her bouquet to her bridesmaids with outstretched hands below, with the words, "Millie caught the bride's bouquet, but everybody present knew that nothing would ever come of it. That she wouldn't be the next to marry by a long ways. And they knew the reason why, too. People with halitosis, unpleasant, bad breath, simply don't get by. It is the unforgivable social fault." Well, at least in America it was. Another ad pictured a dejected young woman in a bridesmaid's dress, clutching the bouquet, resting her face on her hand, pressed against a wall, illustrated with a phrase that would become one of the most successful advertising slogans of all time: "Often a bridesmaid, never a bride." The ads introduced the concept of storytelling to sell a product, imitating the personal interest stories and advice to the lovelorn columns in the tabloid newspapers. As the advertising industry's journal Printer's Ink reflected in a tribute to Feasley, he dealt more with humanity than with merchandise. He wrote advertising dramas rather than business announcements, dramas so common to everyday experience that every reader could easily fit himself into the plot as the hero or the culprit of the action. The ads were a stunning success. Lambert's sales and profits soared. Listerine sales were so strong that they caught the attention of Wall Street. In 1926, Goldman Sachs and Company and another Wall Street firm acquired a larger interest in Lambert Pharmaceutical, with plans to take it public. In the years to come, Lambert constantly sought to expand the market by advancing new uses for Listerine or reintroducing old ones, each promoted in a fresh series of advertisements for women at a certain time of the month, with a condition that could not be mentioned by name at that time. Lambert promoted Listerine for feminine hygiene. A stark headline warned the harm that women do themselves. Intimate use of harsh antiseptics leads to untold damage. Women now hail a gentle, safe means, the text began. The use of harsh, powerful antiseptics in connection with feminine hygiene often results in illness that may lead to an operation. Women suffering thus crowd the hospitals. Will you sooner or later be one of them? Are you going to let half-truths or ignorance of proper measures rob you of vitality, health, and peace of mind? Madison Avenue had crafted a winning formula to get people to buy products based on their anxieties, based upon their fears, and upon their hopes. No industry ultimately would embrace the concept more eagerly or with more stellar results than the pharmaceutical industry. And you know that's where we're at today. They're selling prescription drugs on every news broadcast. Take a look at the CBS Evening News or the ABC or NBC Evening News and then count the number of ads from the pharmaceutical companies. Just pay attention to the pharmaceutical ads that you see on television. I mean, they are selling some pretty heavy-duty stuff. Stuff that has become so popularized that it is taken by millions of people and it's causing tens of thousands of deaths from heart attacks. Hardly a month goes by that some drug isn't withdrawn from the marketplace because it's causing excessive deaths. I mean, that's just Madison Avenue selling drugs. Now, I can't think back. I mentioned earlier, I think the last time I bought a prescription drug was when Doc Olson was giving me penicillin for pneumonia when I was 18 or 19 years old. I think that's the last time. God, that was back in the 1950s. Hell, that was in 1955. Or 54. Well, now the TV ad blitz. Hard as it may be to believe amid the current barrage of drug ads, advertising of prescription drugs to consumers is a fairly recent development. In the first half of the 20th century, doctors wrote out on a prescription pad the various ingredients to treat a cold, fever, infection, or some other condition. Then, a neighborhood pharmacist would then compound or combine all of the substances to create the medication. Now, compounding declined through the 1930s and 40s as manufacturing of specific medicines increased, penicillin, for instance, and other antibiotics and antihistamines were produced by pharmaceutical companies from World War II on. Drugs for high blood pressure and antidepressants arrived in the 1950s. Hence, there was little product advertising beyond the over-the-counter market. Now, with some exceptions, the health and medical ads that the public saw tended to be informational. Typical was one in a July 1947 Saturday Evening Post by Park Davis and Company. It was illustrated by Norman Rockwell in his style drawing of laughing girls leaving a red brick schoolhouse. The headline read, "Some Things You Should Know About Epilepsy." With supporting statistics, the ad began, "Epilepsy is one of the most widely misunderstood of all diseases. Many people believe that there's no effective treatment for epilepsy, that it's a kind of feeble-mindedness, that it always becomes worse as the patient grows older, and that he has no chance of leading a normal life. Your doctor, however, will tell you that these ideas are false. The ad then went on to the punchline. In most cases, modern drugs are the doctor's chief weapon. Only the doctor knows which drug or drugs should be used and in what dosage. Now, that's a 1947 ad in the Saturday Evening Post, July 1947, Saturday Evening Post by Park Davis for epilepsy medication. Well, from the 1950s to the 1970s, most advertising was restricted to specialty journals aimed at doctors. Ads that actually named the drugs for treatment of select diseases or conditions were reserved for medical publications such as the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the Journal of the American Medical Association. Doctors, it was reasoned, would have the knowledge and understanding to weed out all of the hype and then determine which drugs would be best for their patients. In the pages of those esoteric periodicals, pharmaceutical companies promoted their wares to physicians and other healthcare professionals, hopeful that they would generate sales of a new and existing drug. Well, by the 1980s, these same drug companies, in search of a larger market, began advertising in general circulation newspapers and magazines. But television, the medium that would one day revolutionize drug selling, was still largely off limits to anything other than so-called informational commercials. The Food and Drug Administration required that commercials pitching prescription drugs for treatment of specific conditions list the potentially harmful side effects. In other words, recite the fine print on the insert that accompanies the medication. That requirement made TV advertising impractical. Let me pause here. Let me give you a challenge. Go pick up the Reader's Digest. Start flipping through it until you find an ad. I don't care any ad in there for any kind of medicine. And on the first page, you'll see people smiling and happy and green grass and birds and butterflies flying through the air. And they'll tell you, take this drug, Lipitor, or whatever they're selling. Now turn the page, and there will be two full pages of fine print. I want to warn you, you're going to need a 10-power loop. And that's because the drug companies are very ecological-minded people. The reason that they didn't write the side effects, which you're going to find on these two pages of fine print, is because they didn't want to write it in big print and have to take four or five or six pages in the Reader's Digest, which was going to cost them a lot more money for advertising space, but it was going to have tremendous repercussions on the amount of paper and ink that it would take to inform you as to what these side effects might be. We'd have to cut down another tree. So all of the pharmaceutical companies are tree huggers. God bless them anyway. Now, when you get to the side effects section over there, it will tell you what the side effects are from the drug company. I mean, these are the side effects that the drug company admits to. There's probably a bunch more that they left out that they're not admitting to. The FDA nor any other agency has ever tested these drugs. Only the company that manufactures it tests them. Talk about the fox guarding the hen house, huh? And then read, get your 10-power loop. You can get one for $30. Just go, you know, ask. You can go into a jewelry store and tell them, God, I need a 10-power loop. I happen to have one that goes over your head here. I went into a coin store and I've got one of these visor type magnifying glasses. You just put it on your head, you know, like the headset here on the telephone. And you just pull it down, and then you can read legal papers like I do. And if you would ingest that drug after reading the side effects, you've got to be brain dead or mentally incapacitated. And I don't care what ad you read. I don't care what drug it is. I challenge you. Read it and then ask yourself, would I ingest that? Would I give that to my child? Hell, I wouldn't give that to my dog. Well, I kind of like dogs. Hell, I wouldn't give that to a coyote. Hell, I'm more of a man than that. I'd shoot a damn coyote, but I wouldn't torture him to death. Now, all that changed back in 1997. Under pressure from the drug industry, lobbyists and their friends in Congress, the FDA opened the door wide to advertising direct to consumers. It's called DTC, direct to consumers on television. And it allowed commercials to extol a drug as long as they mentioned the major side effects and referred viewers and listeners to more detailed print advertisements that contained complete prescribing information. Now, you take a look at that complete prescribing information, and it's in the Reader's Digest. Well, it's in any magazine where they're advertising drugs, but I like the Reader's Digest because it's a small book to start with, and the fine print in Reader's Digest absolutely requires magnification. Well, of course, unless you're a 15-year-old kid with perfect eyesight. You know, you get to be an old fart like me, and you got to have glasses. Now, I don't wear glasses yet, but, you know, I'm old enough to. But my point is well taken. You can't read, if you're just normal, ordinary folk out there, you won't be able to read that fine print in the Reader's Digest without magnification. Now, that ought to be a red flag to anybody. The only reason that people write in small print, fine print, is so that you won't read it or can't read it because we don't want you to know what that says. Now, why wouldn't a drug company want you to know what the side effects to a drug are? That they would put that in fine print so that you're less likely to read it. In fact, just ask yourself this question. Have you ever read the side effects of the drugs in the Reader's Digest? I'll bet you, if you're honest, you'd say, well, no, I haven't. I didn't until somebody pointed it out to me. I didn't think that they would admit it, but now I can see the logic behind it. See, by putting those side effects in the paper, in the magazine, if you take this drug and it kills you, you're the proximate cause of your own injury. You can't sue for damages. Hell, they told you that you needed your doctor's prescription. They told you that it was going to cause these side effects that could kill you. They warned you, just like they did on cigarettes, you know. They put, Surgeon General says this thing may cause cancer. Be careful. Drug companies selling a product that might cure or harm could reach millions of people with a single message. The profit potential was dazzling, and Madison Avenue, at the behest of the pharmaceutical industry, responded accordingly. In the early months of the changeover, a more than vigilant FDA advised several drug makers that their commercials were misleading, failed to adequately explain possible side effects, or neglected to advise consumers on how to obtain complete information. Among those cited, Merck & Company, Zocor, their ad for cholesterol, Zeneca Pharmaceuticals, now AstraZeneca, it's called a Chlor-8 ad for asthma, and Schering Plough's Claritin ad for allergies. The companies all pulled the questionable commercials. Hey, wait a minute. Questionable commercials? You know, I'm an old-timey salesman, and I'm an old-timey ad man, and advertising is simply a methodology for lying. It's spin. It's deception. Advertising is, by its very nature, deceptive. And it's because we have to tell the truth, so we tell you all the facts that we have to relate, and any facts that we don't have to relate to you, we simply do not relate those facts. So we lead you to a false conclusion for the purposes of convincing you and then ultimately selling you this medication, this automobile, this airplane, or whatever it is that we're trying to sell you, soap, perfume, cereal. Well, there's more on Madison Avenue. We'll take that up next time when we come back. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived by title and date on the Internet. Hey, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.